listening to Inclusive AF with Jackie Clayton and Katie Van Horn.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Inclusive AF podcast. This is Jackie Clayton.
And this is Katie Van Horn. We are here on the day after Election Day, so still a little stressful up in here.
Yeah,
not going to lie, folks, not going to lie. but we're going to, it's all going to come together. It's all going to be great. All right. So today we have a very fun guest, a very interesting guest. And it's not his cat. It's actually him that we're going to interview today. Although we are very excited. If you're watching on YouTube, you get to see his cat in the back. So, you know, just an incentive if you want to watch on YouTube. So Brandilyn Barnett is here with us. Brandilyn, do you want to introduce yourself, share a little bit about yourself with the audience?
Sure, happy to, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm Brandilyn. I'm based in DC and I wear a few different hats, but largely I've spent a career in social impact and technology. Really trying to bridge that gap and build technologies and initiatives and services that, to my mind, move resources to people who need them. So that's taken a few different forms. I was one of the first product managers on a product built within Salesforce. So I helped to design, it was called Salesforce Philanthropy Cloud. We work with hundreds of different countries, companies around the country and around the world to do their employee engagement, their giving and volunteering. I also spent time during COVID, leading Salesforce's work.com well-being solution that was used by half the states and hundreds of different companies to ensure that people were doing well during COVID. And then I worked on Salesforce's net zero or sustainability cloud, and went from there to be chief product officer for Y Combinator, that company building a similar employee engagement solution. And so today I, again, wear a few hats. I'm founder of a company called The Regular, based in Washington, D.C., that helps people find communities they want to join and then connects those community gatherings to local venues. I'm also chief product officer for a company called Humanitas.ai that's using alternative data to help make more inclusive decisions around things like financial decisions, hiring, as well as cause marketing. Working with large enterprises like and organizations like Mr. Beast. And finally, I'm an elected official here in DC. I'm on the board of a local organization called the Catalog for Philanthropy and a couple of others. And I just try to stay busy, but that goal is always to move resources to people who need them. And then finally, I think the reason I'm here is I told my story in a memoir published last year called Dreams Deferred, Recession, Struggle, and the Quest for a Better World, that talks a lot about all the different experiences I've kind of had and what that has been like to kind of go through life with very few resources, single mom, grew up in Dallas, very poor, to try to do work that makes a difference, but not be completely poor and broke, and kind of the struggles that I had there. So I'm excited to be here today and to talk with you both.
We might owe you a copay at the end of this today. I have so many questions.
I don't even know what direction I want to go in. I want to go into AI direction first, just because that is one that I think is so fascinating. I think we could go in a lot of different directions. So, okay, first let's start with your book though. No. So what was your... Why did you write the book? Like, what was your impetus? What was the thing that made you sit down, take the time, and actually, you know, share your story?
Yeah, I wrote Dreams Deferred for two reasons. The first was that, you know, I start the book telling my story of my rock bottom, you know, walking through the streets of San Francisco. I'd gone to grad school. I'd, you know, done good work. But at that point, this is around 2010, I could not find anyone to give me a job. And so at some point I'm walking around the streets of San Francisco, just trying to find a space to sleep for the night. I couldn't even afford to get back to the South Bay, the $14 for the train. I was living with my brother on his couch. And I wrote the book because my experience at that time was hopeless. And there were times that I recount in the book where I wanted to end my life, and I was very close to doing so. My mother had passed away. No one would hire me. I wanted to do work that made a difference, but I couldn't find a job that paid more than, you know, $10 or $12 an hour, even when I could find a job in the nonprofit space. And so I wanted anyone who's kind of going through that struggle, especially as I was in the kind of heat of writing during COVID and feeling even more alone and kind of remembering a lot of those feelings, I thought that if one person out there reads my story and realizes that there's hope, that they can make it through that moment in their lives, that it's worth sharing my story. And so that was the first reason. The second reason was, one of my takeaways from that time was that the world of social impact is not very inclusive. I spent time as the head of research at an organization called the Council on Foundations, and it is the National Association for Big Philanthropies. So I worked with organizations like the Gates Foundation to figure out, we did an annual survey, how much were people paid? What was the composition of staff? What were best practices? And at that time, I got to do some nationally kind of leading research with decades of survey history on how women and people of color were represented in the philanthropic space. And it became very clear to me why I had struggled to find jobs in philanthropy and social impact, because there's not a lot of representation, there's not a lot of inclusion, there's not a lot of opportunity. The data on that is incredibly clear. And so what I wanted to do was share my story with people in the social impact space as well, and basically say, hey, if we've got this movement, these institutions and these organizations that claim they want to make the world a better place, why aren't they inclusive? Because how can we build something better when we don't do it together in a way that takes in feedback from all different people from all different walks of life and backgrounds? What world are we building when it's not inclusive? And so that I wanted to kind of challenge the social impact space to think about inclusion in a way that I think too often doesn't happen.
I love that you say that, because so often, excuse me, what I found is that, especially if the organization isn't inclusive, they're answering questions that weren't asked. Like, they're not asking the questions of the right people oftentimes, and make, like, sitting in a room, it's really that confirmation bias of, let's all, you know, I have an idea, and you're trying to provide a need without making the assessment of how we got there. I think that was one of the, I've done some work with nonprofits, not for social impact, but just found that to be the case. What were some of the answers that you found out as to why, or did you find anything that you felt made a little sense as you were looking for the answers to those
questions? Where I've settled is that, I mean, first, I agree with you completely. And I think about, and it's so obvious to me, I think about my experience building products. So I've been a product manager with major tech companies, smaller startups. And no matter the organization, no matter what you're trying to build, the first and most important thing that you need to do is listen. So you go into a room with a group of potential customers or a group of existing customers, and you ask them, what problems are they facing? What are their pain points? And you use that to derive a solution that can make their lives easier that they might be willing to pay for. That's what a product manager does. Then you figure out how to tell the story of it, et cetera. I think that so often that doesn't happen in the social impact space, that doesn't happen in philanthropy, and it doesn't even happen with a lot of governmental and multilateral institutions who just go in and kind of decide what the priorities are before having that conversation. And when I think about a solution, there are a lot of things that need to happen. The first is that there aren't even enough people. It's just inclusion in and of itself. So philanthropy and social impact talk to themselves a lot. Yeah, you have a conference and, you know, a lot of folks will go and they work in big foundations or small foundations. They're talking to each other, and that's great. But then you go into the community. So here in DC, for example, I was for a time a mentor at Thurgood Marshall Academy, which is in DC's Ward 8 in Anacostia, predominantly African-American part of town. Kids a lot like me and how I grew up. I know for a fact that mentor program at that high school is being funded by foundations here in the DC area. Why is it then that when I talk to the student I was mentoring or other students, their friends or their parents, they don't even know what those foundations are or that they exist.
Yeah.
But that line of communication between the people being served and the people providing funding is not strong. And I think it needs to be stronger. And once that, so I think that's one of the pieces that I always say needs to change. Once that change occurs, I then think that you can begin to inspire people to want to work for the kinds of organizations that change their lives. That's kind of how I got on this career. My mother and I were helped so many times by different organizations, and I wanted to do for others what had been done for me. I didn't want to just be helped. I wanted to help. And so that begins to create a pipeline of people who want to have careers in the space, as opposed to now millions of people who don't even know that options exist to work at a foundation. So those are that kind of awareness at a broader scale, I think, would help a lot. Beyond that, I think transparency is the root of a lot of the issues, in the sense of, I think back to a job that I had that I don't need to be specific about, but we were still going to work in person. This was before COVID, and there's a water cooler effect where the CEO would come in and she would, you know, have her coffee in the kitchen and talk to the folks she enjoyed talking to in the kitchen. And those folks happened to look like her. And that is not a transparent situation, because she might end up saying, oh, there's an opportunity in the company to do X. There's a new job that we're going to be opening. And those things are just happening in the normal course of conversation. But because it's not transparent to the entire organization, other people end up missing out on opportunities they might otherwise see. And that's kind of a microcosm, I think, of what leads to a lot of uninclusive practices in the social impact space, but also more broadly. Just this idea of, does everyone know about all the opportunities that are available equally, and what it might take to get there, and what kind of salary it might even pay, even that kind of transparency. You know, growing up as a kid, the idea of making $50,000 kind of blew my mind. Like, that was far and away more than anybody in my family could imagine making. And then I started learning about careers in tech and other things just through contacts with other people. And I'm like, wow, the bar was set so low for me from the beginning. Now I have something to aim for. And I knew about careers in the social impact space. And so while it was a difficult journey, you know, all the elements that I'm talking about kind of cascade into a scenario where you create a more inclusive world. But anyway, that might be a little rambly, but hopefully just a little context into how I think about these issues, at least, but you know, not to pretend that they're easy issues to solve.
No, but I think it's so important. A moment, you know, we all have those moments that have changed our life, or something, the way we think about something can be so simple. And I'll never forget, we were trying to solve the problem of food deserts in Waco, and they had a lot of people that came to a groundwater. It's a organization that teaches about groundwater. And we were all sitting there, and they were talking about building these farms and building these urban farms. And this woman said, have you ever had broccoli? You ever smelled broccoli before when you make it in the microwave? It's like, what does it smell like? It's like broccoli. It's like, okay. Can you imagine if you've never smelled broccoli before, and then someone told you you had to eat it? So who's going to use the broccoli on this farm? Who's going to eat that? And it was like, no. Mind blowing. I was like, what? You know? Yeah. And finally, one person who had been too afraid to speak up said, I didn't have fresh vegetables until I was 25 years old. I thought vegetables came in a can. And then it was like, wait, we're solving the wrong problem. And I think that's what happens so often. And I think it's really telling. My family is from the Baltimore area. And I think that it happens a lot, where you see people wanting to help and offer, but not wanting the sense of community, or not wanting to invest personally in the community that they are serving in a way so that they can answer the real, or try to solve the real problem, or look at it from a 360 view.
The example you use is so funny, because I tell the same story. It's very similar. I was in Dallas, and there was a small organization I was working with, and they were trying to think about issues of nutrition in Southern Dallas, which is the more kind of underprivileged part of the city. let's be real, parts of it look like war zone.
Yes.
And so there were three people of color as part of this group. I was one, there was two other ladies. We weren't able to attend two of the meetings. So we come back after missing a couple of meetings and everyone's really excited. All, you know, white folks, no offense to anybody, they're excited about this fresh vegetables program that they're gonna do. And I'm sitting there like, my single mom would not, these fresh veggies are gonna go bad so quickly. And like the nutritional value of these fresh veggies versus frozen veggies, the data is pretty clear. Mm-hmm. It's not that different. So why are you doing this? Who told you that this is a good idea? And it really does go back to this idea of why, when you build something, you need to listen to the people you're building that solution for. And too often that doesn't happen. And just to go off on a little, this has kind of been a little passion of mine that I kind of indulge in my political work here in DC, but also in my volunteering, is this idea that corporate America hasn't distilled or rather passed down its techniques in a way that it did in previous generations. So when you think about the assembly line, it was used by Ford Motor Company and other big corporations to improve the means of production and make their factories more efficient, et cetera. But over time, we use the assembly line for a variety. We see it at soup kitchens. We see it when we do volunteer efforts to ship out clothing or materials to people in need. The assembly line became a part of broader culture, and those techniques that drove efficiency in business also made the world better in a million little ways. Now, when you think about big tech, a lot of the techniques I use as a product manager, for example, to go out and learn from millions of users in real time about what they're thinking, what problems they're facing, what they might like to see as solutions. For some reason, we have not taken those techniques and applied them to everyday life. And even if you think about our democracy, you know, it's the day after Election Day, the whole idea that like you have local elected officials with maybe 100,000 constituents or even a million constituents, and they can only learn what those constituents think one day every 4 years or every 2 years or whatever their term may be, that's absurd. When I'm sitting here looking at platforms at Salesforce or Facebook or Meta or whatever other company, and they're getting real-time feedback from people and communities on a daily basis to drive solutions that they're building that, yes, in many cases, especially if you think about certain organizations in the social media landscape, are making the world worse, but they're building for a purpose. They know what those solutions are going to be used for, and they're gathering real-time feedback. And we need to start utilizing those same tools and techniques in every part of our life so that we can learn from and listen to each other. So that's been kind of a little, just a thing on my mind for a long time that I've thought about, how can I make this better? But it is just so true. It happens far too often that there's just not good listening.
I think that, you know, that's something that like pretty much every guest that we have had on, that's one of the major themes is, you know, who is listening, what are they, and across the board. And, you know, you're talking and it's reminding me, and I don't know if you have read the Decolonizing Wealth by Edgar Villanueva. Like,
I know, like, Edgar well.
Great book. And I've heard him speak now a few times, and it's fascinating because it's that same concept of, if the people in power in these philanthropic groups or in these nonprofits don't actually know what's going on or have the lived experience or are listening to the communities that they're helping, you know, how can that just completely twist the actual what is needed versus what is delivered, you know? And it's what's the analogy of, like, you know, hey, giving people shoes, you know, when they don't actually need shoes, they need socks or something, you know, like, there's so many different analogies. And I think, you know, that whole concept of who's actually doing the listening to. So I've worked with a few nonprofits here in town. And one of the things that we talk about is, like, the board, like, who is on your board? And do you have folks from the communities that you're trying to support and grow so they can inform on some of these things of, hey, yeah, if you give fresh vegetables, that's not going to be great, but frozen vegetables would absolutely be helpful. And that listening piece is just something that I think gets dismissed so much, because there is that savior, oh, we know the answers, we're going to give you what you need, even if it's not what you need.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I want to tell you about my podcast called Can I Offer You Some Feedback? I'm a business consultant and executive coach with over 20 years experience in change management, leadership development, and naturally providing feedback to high performers. My podcast is for those of you who have a complicated relationship with feedback, whether giving, receiving, avoiding, or seeking. Feedback is essential for our development. In each episode, you'll hear from real people across industries with their ideas, perspectives, and best practices on feedback. I'll also be sharing business bites with you, simple explanations of organizational tools, management techniques, and leadership philosophies that will help you and your businesses thrive. You can listen to Can I Offer You Some Feedback on your favorite podcast app, or learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com.
Yeah, it happens a lot in the environmental space too. And that's, you know, that's something I've been thinking about a lot. You know, COP27, I think, is underway. Or just wrapped up last week. I've honestly found it hard to follow the news. It gets depressing sometimes. But just this idea, think about recycling, for example. Oh, it's this really great thing. A lot of the things that people were recycling were just ended up getting dumped in communities of color. So, you know, what were you really doing? But anyway, I do think it's a core problem. And I don't know, the world is so polarized, maybe we don't want to listen to each other. Who knows? But I'm feeling perhaps more cynical today than some other.
I think we all are.
Yeah. It's a rough day. Can we switch over to AI? Because I want to hear some of your thoughts on. So I Coded Bias, you know, the movie Coded Bias, that Joy, and I can never say her last name correctly, so I don't want to butcher it. So what are your thoughts on kind of the use of AI in technology and kind of in these spaces that we're trying to improve, and how that impacts marginalized and underserved groups? Like, just would love your thoughts.
Yeah. I take a lot of my cues there from the founder of Humanitas. If anyone's interested, it's humanitas.ai. You're welcome to go check out the solution currently. Building out a means of collecting alternative data sources, much of it from nonprofits, and feeding that into machine learning tools used by larger institutions. But I think the truth of the matter is, and when you hear Phil speak, the CEO and founder, he'll talk about how the current picture that the internet provides of people is incomplete. And where it is complete, it's biased to be complete for certain cohorts of people versus and not for others. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that when you're being considered for a mortgage, or when you're being evaluated for hiring, or when a system is deciding which nonprofit to show to a donor, say when they're checking out at the grocery store, because that picture that the internet paints is incomplete and becoming more incomplete by the day, because think of where all that data is coming from. It's coming from e-commerce tools. Well, you have to have the money to go use those tools. It's painting pictures and models being built on data used by Facebook and other systems. Well, if you don't have the internet or reliable internet access, just as an example, that's not painting a picture of you and of your life. And so what needs to happen is some kind of systematic way of bringing in alternative data sources, cleaning them up, making sure they're valid, and then piping them in wherever they need to be. It's almost like we need a new infrastructure for the internet. So that's what we're working on with Humanitas, in conversations with some large brands, to do everything from have the small local charity, perhaps run by a person of color, show up when you're checking out at a major grocery chain, and have it not just be Feeding America or Save the Children. Great organizations, but there are small nonprofits right down the street that may actually increase the likelihood that someone's going to donate because it's in their community and people do like local. Or if we can use nonprofit data to say, actually, there's a, you know, the services that are being provided in this community make it more likely that someone's going to be able to pay a loan back, and then passing that information to a big bank so that they can update their model, paint a more clear picture, and not deny people of color who can pay back that mortgage or who can pay back that loan that might help them jumpstart their dreams and their business. But all of that is possible when you have a different infrastructure for the internet and a wider variety of data sources. And so it's been really exciting to work on that problem with the Humanitas team.
I love that you're doing that. It's kind of the challenge. I always say, I won't tell you my exact age, but I'm a Gen Xer. Mm-hmm. And when I started getting into talent acquisition, we used to recruit very differently. We were looking for people where the job that we had was their next opportunity. And now when you see with the flood of ML and AI, especially in some of these HR tech tools, at best, you can find somebody that's only like 2 years burnt out. At worst, you're hiring somebody who's been doing the exact same job, and literally you have no expectations outside of what you read for them at your current job. You're hiring mm-hmm. them to do the same thing because that's the data set you're using. Is like that's a prime example, because I've explained to others the underrepresented person, and that literally, and I mean that sometimes, you know, if it's black, I say black, if it's brown, I say brown, but it literally underrepresented might have a different journey. And I was thinking about it the other day as we were looking for a director of communications. Mm-hmm. And I was like, don't look for other directors of communications. I was like, look for people who have the work. Like, we have to look at it differently. Like, what if this, you know, there's the rules, it wasn't set up for people that are underrepresented, the systems that we see in place. And then you have to have that understanding of what those situations look like. I mean, I just, you know, again, like I said, I'm in a mood today because of what's going on. But I also feel like we have, like, language, we always say, is the operating system of inclusion. Mm. And it's so important that we can get the right people in the room, because you're right, there's a lot of access. You just kind of sparked an idea. I mean, it's like, we have technology that we can use, you know, right, you know, a phone call away, a Slack message away, of making sure that those things are happening. And because sometimes people will donate that technology, right? Yeah. But then they donate it to a group that doesn't know how to utilize it outside of, like, oh, we'll do a survey at the end of this event. And it's like, wait, that's the survey, the people that we just met? No, we want more than that. We're trying to change lives. And I think we have to get more intentional with what we're trying to do, especially at these nonprofits, of what the actual goal is, and give people opportunities to make very specific changes. I just see so many that are trying to do be all things for all people. And it gets messy and things don't get done.
Yeah, and where to begin? I think the problem of how to use technology to better the world is one of the biggest problems that we're going to face this century. There were a lot of companies between 2000 and today that said they were doing that. You know, you've got Google, you've got now Meta or Facebook, you've got Twitter, which was the town square. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of people, a lot of organizations just don't know how to effectively use technology in positive ways. And we're not exactly teaching people. I remember when I got to college, I took a communications class, and they, you know, part of what we learned, I was probably a sophomore in college, I went to the University of Pittsburgh, and they were telling us that, oh, you've got to be careful about what you read, or, you know, where you hear a recommendation of a book, because of mergers and acquisitions, you might be watching ABC and they're talking about a book. Well, they also own the publishing company. And that's just the kind of thing that we should really be teaching people when they're like 5 years old. We should be teaching people about all the different tools and technologies they can use when they're very young, so that we began to make that just a part of how we go about our lives in society, and so that we all understand the tools available and the harms that they can do, as well as the ways that they can help us. Instead, I think we've gone in the opposite direction. You've got people in the Senate asking, you know, asking the most ridiculous questions to people that work in technology or any new space. And the example set is that none of this matters, but in fact, it's rapidly transforming the world around us in ways that we aren't really equipped as a society to think through fully. And so I think that is unfortunate. I'm sorry, I got very distracted. I noticed you have a Houston Tillerson. My mom went there, so.
Son TJ is there, and my oldest graduated from there. My brother's a Houston Tillotson graduate. So go Rams. We'll just throw that in there.
Don't meet a lot of folks from Houston Tillotson up here in DC, but it won. Yes. My
family's like Morgan. That my family went to Morgan. My sister went to Howard. And then my grandparents went to Coppin. Teachers college. So long. And so that part of the world. And, you know, it's funny how it is. And I tell everyone, regardless of your background, you really should go to an HBCU. The change in my children, where they can get the work done and see these changes and make a difference. This is a prime example of what you're talking about. So, there's the student commission for the city of Austin, and my son's on the student commission, and I was really missing him one day. So I was like, I'm going to pop in and listen to the live broadcast. It was during COVID. And I was like, they're calling him like Commissioner Clayton, and he's on the transportation commission along with people from UT and people from Austin Community College. And the things that they were able to learn. But then you look at the history, it hasn't been that long where they invited and treated everybody equally from the various universities, and having these people collaborate is driving real change. And the fact, because I was like, you ain't no commissioner. He's like, no, really, I am. I have an email address to the city. Like, I'm a part of this. And it's been life-changing for him, but also for the city, of getting the right voices in there, of trying to make change. And I just wish everybody had that in mind. Sorry, we're going off on a tangent, but I feel like it's so relevant. And I think we're going to see an increase as we're starting to educate ourselves about what's really happening. I think we'll see an increase in enrollees at HBCUs. I think we're starting to see the change on television of that representation, because a lot of the times we want to be able to solve all these issues and we need more hands in some of these scenarios. And you're realizing you're working on these causes, but the benefit isn't necessarily for me or for a larger group or within that community. So I must ask, since your mom was an alum, how did you end up in Pittsburgh? That is far from Texas.
So I started applying to schools, and I always had this fascination with the East Coast, and I love winter. I hadn't experienced it a lot, but I love snow. I still do. I wanted to go somewhere with seasons. And so I was deciding between, I had an opportunity to go to UT Dallas for a year and then do the UT thing, which literally everyone did. Or I could go to the University of Pittsburgh, and I forget what other option I had, maybe Davidson or something. And what sealed the deal for me was I got up one morning, one summer in Texas. I was living with my mom, and I had lost our home. We were living with an aunt in the Colony, Texas. And so I get up in the morning, it's probably 6 a.m., thinking I'm going to go beat the heat, play some basketball. You know, I'm deciding which school to go to. I'm done with high school. Walked out. It was already 104 degrees or something at 6 in the morning. And I said, you know what? I'm going to pick. that was
decision made.
And I haven't looked back since. I did go back to Dallas for a bit after undergrad and before grad school. But I love the East Coast, and I also love DC. I love that, you know, growing up, there was not a lot of opportunity for me to see role models who are people of color. So you know, there were amazing people in my life, but compared to here in DC, where you've got appointed and elected officials, you know, the mayor, much of the city council, many of the major nonprofit organizations run by people of color. And I love that there's that culture and history here in DC and more broadly on the East Coast. I just feel like there's more of that. And I like having that. I also like the diversity in that there's so many people from every country in the world here in DC to engage in political issues and advocacy. And then just a few hours away, you're in New York and there's people from all over the planet there to enjoy the city, there for finance, to transact, to meet people, to find community, to chase their dreams. And I just think the East Coast just has so much of that, and it invigorates me. If I'm alone too much, I'm in my head, and that's not always the best place to be. So I was drawn to the East Coast, and Pittsburgh was the bridge, but Pittsburgh's a beautiful and amazing city. So really loved my time there.
I love that. That's a great story. And yeah, 104. Yeah, I can see that day would have been.
We're familiar. We're familiar with these temperatures. Yes.
Yes.
Very relevant. So critical thinking, you know, like what you're talking about is just, you know, the whole idea of getting people to think critically. And how do we start to get that more into schools? Because I think, you know, as all of us, especially like in the political climate right now, I think it is that, can you just stop and stop listening to this one channel and go ask some questions and go do your own research and have that critical thinking piece? How do we get people to do that more? Like I
think the fundamental course that everyone needs to take, that we need to teach in, you know, multiple grades of school, is research. And that includes quantitative research, so going in and being able to look at and analyze data sets, but also qualitative research, knowing that if you're building a product and you hope to have 30 B2B customers, just to give you an example, because right now with the regular, we're building B2B solutions for local bars and restaurants. If we know we want to have 120 customers in DC in year one of operation, I need to be able to get into the room with between 10 and 20 and really dig in on and find a problem that we can address that fits our business model and understand how our solution, just have conversations and do that kind of qualitative research. What's your problem? Hey, what if we did this? How much would you pay for that? Or what would you think about that? And just having those kinds of honest conversations and then being able to synthesize both that qualitative research and whatever quantitative research you can do and draw from, as well as whatever meta study you can do, whatever research you're able to do outside of that, or take advantage of work that others have done to learn. We need to be teaching those kinds of standard, truly standard now in the modern business landscape, research techniques to every person in this country. And the fact that we're not is really terrifying, because to be quite honest, there are so many decisions that need to be made, and there's so much data that we all have to sort through that we don't even know how to sort through. I mean, it's actually completely unfair in the current landscape to expect people to genuinely and authentically engage and participate when we haven't given them the tools to do so effectively, to analyze data, to do research. That shouldn't be, you know, I think I was reading that one of the fastest growing jobs is data scientists. And it shouldn't just be people with the title of data scientists who are able to do that. That kind of skill set is kind of essential just for functioning in modern society, and we haven't caught up.
Just order a freaking pizza, from your hotel room, wherever you visit. I hear what you're saying. I think the thing that I'm most frustrated is that we don't teach applied math or applied science. And so people don't know what that looks like out there. I remember my oldest was a math major, and I felt really guilty. We were going to Six Flags, and I felt really bad because it was like a misty day, and it was before school was let out, and there was like, I don't know, 100 people there, and there should have been like thousands. And I was like, oh, I feel so bad. They're not going to make any money. And then Clay said, actually, they've already figured it out, Mom. You do not have to feel bad. Like, they have already worked in this rainy day into the format after they learned it. I was like, what else do you know? And we were talking about how to calculate the wind and all of these different things. And they love math and they were so excited, but it started with showing them all the things that are math that you don't know what is math. And it's the same thing, I think, with data. Like telling somebody, oh, you should study research may be boring, but it's like your favorite band's in town and there's a coupon. What do? Like, you only have $100. If you can get a coupon, you can get two tickets or you can buy one ticket. Like, what do you do online to do that? Because there's so many resources. But also allow people to say, when you don't find it, you can create it. There's more world as big and vast as the internet and interwebs are. Maybe it's not there yet. Maybe it's you that have to come up with the solution. Maybe it's not Googleable.
The Jim Stroud Podcast explores the discoveries and trends forming the future of our lives. Brain-to-brain communication, robot bosses, microchip implants for workers, and artificial intelligence replacing human workers are all happening now. If you want to know what's happening next, subscribe now to the Jim Stroud Podcast.
Yeah. And what you're really talking about is an opportunity to unlock innovation. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we dance around a lot is, you know, the techniques that we're talking about, the things that we're talking about, identifying problems, identifying solutions. That's something that we kind of laud certain people for. And it tends to be a certain kind of person, to be quite frank, a white guy in a hoodie in Silicon Valley. If we taught these techniques to every entrepreneur, every small business owner, every person, imagine what we could do as a society. You're kind of talking about unlocking our potential to solve problems and innovate, and not just holding that as a kind of limited resource among an elite kind of strata of people. And I think, why wouldn't we want to do that? I talk a lot in my book about Star Trek, because it is specifically Captain Picard, the Next Generation, all of that has inspired me so much. And that's literally that model, you know, that world that we can not necessarily try to copy or emulate or build, but that we can take inspiration from. And at the core of it is everyone is educated, supported, fed, they have a place to live. And once that happens, wow, then you can unlock, you can give people the tools to figure out different problems, follow their passions and solve those problems and find solutions. And some of them are going to change the world. Some of them are going to change individual people's lives and perceptions in a way that leads them to change the world through art or music. And I think that's the world that we should be trying to create. And instead we're fighting over whether, you know, we should forgive student loans. Oh. And it's like, we need to decide kind of, we're at a very crucial point, I think, as a society where we have to decide kind of what are we trying to do? Are we trying to make money? Or are we trying to make the world better so that more and more people have opportunity, have food? And then what happens when they do? We can unlock their creative genius in a million different ways, but we have to give people the tools that they need and the resources that they need. And I try to do as much of that as I can. That's why I'm compelled to wear so many different hats. But it's a tough job, and we're doing, unfortunately, you're kind of swimming against the tide, to be frank, if you even try to think about the world in that way.
I think you're right, but there are those questions. I was just talking to the language team. I thought this was fascinating. So I work for a company that creates tools to help build, bring people together through language. And so the person who was doing NLP work said, we're looking on an accommodation statement. So what would be the right, like what's required in an accommodation statement? And I said, oh, it's not required. And she looked at me and said, it's not. I was like, uh-uh. You could just put, we follow EEOC rules. So it puts it in there, but you don't, there's no language that you have to use.
No.
And she said, well, we still want to have an accommodation statement. And I said, well, before I answer, are you trying to be compliant or are you trying to save the world? Because if you're trying to be compliant, let's just shut this down. The answer is you don't have to have one. So it's like, no, we want to know more. And then I was telling them, I was like, oh, yes, P.S. Let's talk about the challenges that people with disabilities face. Let's talk about not being paid a fair wage. It's legal. Let's talk about all of those things. And it goes to your, it touches on exactly what you're talking about. Like, number one, that is a Googleable answer. Number two, you haven't surrounded yourself with the people to get some of these answers where we're looking, we have to look at it. Do you want to make money? Or are we trying to make the world better? And I think in some situations, the history has, they've been so used to helping people make money through this wizardry of technology that they forget that people have been giving me the questions to ask instead of me using my critical thinking. And I think it's a nice combination of people, again, of bringing those people together. Because I mean, for me, coding would be my own personal hell. Like I look at it, I start having a panic. I'm like, what's happening? There's dots, there's dashes. I really can't do it.
Well, and I think it's also just adding to that layer. Why does it have to be either or? Why can't it be both, that you make money and save the world? And
you can. Right.
You know
that's
what I mean?
Right.
Like, I think that's part of it as well. And I think that's, you know, where I am seeing people trying to move. It just is, it is a heavy, heavy lift.
Why do teachers have to take a vow of poverty?
Right.
Yeah. Or work people who work in nonprofits.
Yeah.
Right. And like social work.
Yep. I call it impact anywhere.
Yeah.
I call that impact anywhere. And I really, like I mentioned, I want to challenge the social impact space to say that the way you have an impact, you don't have to work at a foundation, you don't have to work at a nonprofit. You can have an impact anywhere, in any job that you're doing. Let's say you're at a large company. There are people who need a voice within that organization so that they can achieve the kind of transparency that leads to inclusion and leads to opportunity for all. A lot of companies have started up groups that are called typically employee resource groups or business resource groups. You can volunteer in your role to help lead one of those internal organizations, and you can help to transform your workplace culture in a way that helps other people to live more full lives, to have their well-being respected, to find new opportunities. That impact is tremendous. And you don't have to be at a nonprofit or foundation to do that. And I think that's the core message of Dreams Deferred, that you, and something I learned trying so hard. I spent a decade trying to get work in a nonprofit. That was my dream. Doing NGO work, something along those lines that helped us to move closer to a better world and help the world to be a better place. And all the while, I watched my mom die. I had no health insurance. I couldn't help her. I'm taking her around a doctor. I could do nothing for her. I had no money. And I, you know, ended up almost homeless on the streets of San Francisco. I had so many times I had to get people to help me to go to college or to go to grad school. And I went to grad school in London because I got into my dream school, University of London. I got there and I had no money. I had to borrow from friends to live in a hostel for 3 months. And then I found a room in a house with six other people at the top of a bunk bed. And I was doing all that to get an education and make my life better. But it didn't, you know, the social impact work I had done before that and did after couldn't even pay the student loans that I got to, you know, pursue those opportunities. And it's like, I just keep coming back to, what's the point of all of this, right? What's the point of the society that we're building? Is it really just to make some people some money? Because if it's not, then we need to think about higher purpose, and we need to not restrict that higher purpose to certain careers and certain people. It needs to be something that can happen anywhere. And so I call that impact anywhere. I'm trying to start a series around it of conversations I have with people who are trying to have an impact in tech, in art, in finance, and just thinking about the impact of their actions and the work that they can do and that they are doing on the world around them. That needs to be a mindset that we all adopt.
1,000,000%. And I think, you know, you mentioned ERGs, BRGs, and I think one of the pieces that I am very passionate about, I know Jackie is as well, is it doesn't have to be a volunteer position either. If in your organization, you're asking folks to do this work, which is a heavy lift, they should be compensated for that work as well. And so I think it's again, it's continuing this conversation, like, you know, the vow of poverty that teachers are taking constantly and, you know, having to come out of pocket on so many things. Why is that where we are as a society versus the opposite? And, you know, actually taking care of folks who are doing this work to make organizations better, to make the world better. And, you know, how do we shift that narrative? But
whose idea was it to have Brandilyn in the morning?
I know. I was
like, I'm gonna be distracted all day.
I have 4,000 other topics I want to cover.
I was like, why? We don't have to have Brandilyn back.
Yes.
I need you to come to text it. Listen, I just have a whole dossier for you. I have a whole itinerary.
I'm not coming in the summer. I'll tell you that.
Well, I'll just say, as soon as it snows in DC, you can come out to Arizona and Jackie will come out. We'll have a whole situation. So it'll be
a pool party.
Yeah, pool party. All right. Well, the last question we like to ask is really around, you know, what is one thing that you want folks to, I'm going to switch it just for you, Jackie, that you want them to have heard during this episode, or is one message that you want people to just be aware of as they're moving about their day?
I'd say,
that right, Jackie?
That was good. That was good.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
No, of course. I'd say it's that message from my book. And so maybe I'm breaking the rules with your question, but it's kind of two interrelated pieces. The first is, and you know, a lot of the stories I recount in my book are things I experienced during the 08 recession, the Great Recession. And, you know, we all went through COVID and that was terrible. And I thought, you know, I'd finish the book during COVID and people could read it as they were going through all of that. And now look, we're out of COVID in many ways. And here we are back again with a potential recession looming and that hundreds of thousands of people getting laid off across different sectors. And I would just encourage everybody to just remember that there's hope. Like when you're feeling down, my story is just one, but there are many other people who are there for you. If you want to talk, you can reach out to me, but just know that there's hope. All it takes is one person to say yes in a job interview. You don't worry about all the people that say no. All it takes is just one. It's just remember that there's hope. And then as you keep that message in mind and go forward in your life, the big takeaway for me is don't think that you have to compromise. You can have impact in whatever job you do and whatever thing you do, you can have impact anywhere. And remember that and kind of adapt that as your mindset. And doing that together en masse as a people, I think is what's gonna make the world a better place. It's not people donating money, it's not people volunteering, it's everyone thinking about how they can make an impact in everything they do. It's a mindset. And I think that would be the main takeaway. Just ask yourself in your current job or in your current life, what can you do to make an impact? And there's something, and doing so, my guess is, and what I've experienced as well, is that's going to help you and your career and your family and you and your community as well. And it's going to pay big dividends in a variety of different ways. So I think those are the things that I would leave people with.
Well, I think especially right now, as we are facing a possible recession again, your book is, you know, one of those books that, like, read it now as we continue down this path and hopefully don't go down that path too far. But how can your book and how can the, you know, impact question really change the way people approach whatever comes next? Jackie, what you got?
I want people to take away that I like that there's hope, but also that you're not alone. I think sometimes, like at night in the quiet corners, you can feel alone, but knowing that you are out there and there's other people out there that is the hope that I'm taking this morning, the day after the election, that it was interesting as we look at some of the results. Some of us do think differently, but there are people that I can align with and help share those messages for everyone. And Lord knows it can start right here at home in Waco, Texas. And we can just keep expanding. And also that as you're looking for the person to lead a various cause, remember, it could be you. You could be the one that needs to lead that charge. Mm-hmm. You're on mute, boo-boo.
Sorry, I had to take pen in. The idea of critical thinking and taking in, you know, the data, that there is so much data, and I love that you point that out. The amount of data that we are taking in on a daily basis, how do we, you know, take out the fluff or the unnecessary and really focus on the key information and do that critical thinking to say, what else, why, and keep asking those questions. Like, I think that's something that we all need to take as a to-do, especially just it, again, back to in current times, like it, knowing that some of these things, like, why is this set up this certain way? Why do we have situations where the most important roles are underfunded? Why? Just tell me why. Sorry. Well, Brandilyn, thank you. We are definitely going to have a part two. Just because, yeah, I was creating a list before we started and I got to two of them. So that works out. There's only like 17 more. So it's going
to
be great.
Happy to come back. I very much enjoyed the conversation.
Awesome. Well, thank you for taking the time.
Yes, thank you.
This is Katie Van Horn.
And this is Jackie Clayton.
Bye.
Bye.
Do you love news about LinkedIn, Indeed, Google, and just about every other recruitment tech company out there?
Hell yeah. I'm Chad.
I'm Cheese.
We're the Chad and Cheese Podcast.
All the latest recruiting news and insights are on our show.
Dripping in snark and attitude.
Subscribe today wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We out.